This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we're covering various protests that have gone on around the country, particularly on two issues. First, we'll cover the protests that were held across the country and around the world, objecting to the freeing of Posada. Posada, as you recall, is the former CIA agent, allegedly the mastermind of blowing up a Cuban airliner and killing 73 people on that airline. We'll also hear from protesters and others who are at the appeals hearing that might, hopefully, finally get Mamiya out of jail. It's a hearing that took place at the U.S. Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. Our own Heidi Boghossian and other protesters were there for that hearing. And finally, we'll give you an update on habeas corpus, on the case of Jose Padilla, and on the new war czar. War czar, think about that. Pretty amazing in this country. Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
This is Michael Ratner, and I'm on the phone with Dahlia Hashad, who is in Washington, and our listeners well know. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm all right. Today we want to bring our listeners an update on a number of issues, but particularly the status of habeas corpus. That's the right of any defendant, any person in prison, to go to court and challenge their detention. As many of our listeners know, we've been covering this issue around Guantanamo for a long time. 5.5 years of litigation in which we've attempted, and I say we, a number of human rights groups and civil liberties groups out there, particularly the Center for Constitutional Rights and AI, Amnesty International, have led a fight to try and restore habeas. We've twice been to the Supreme Court. Twice the Supreme Court has said you have a right to habeas, and twice Congress has overridden that Supreme Court decision, which was not based on the Constitution but based on a statute. They've stripped the statute out of the statute books and relegated the Guantanamo detainees and other non-citizens to an alternative process that does nothing to guarantee their rights to challenge their detentions. Our hopes were, and I say our, the broad sort of sector of civil liberties and human rights people, our hopes were that because we were not very successful in the courts in the last round, that we would have some chance in the Democratic Congress of restoring habeas. And pursuant to that, a number of the human rights groups, as well as the Center for Constitutional Rights, plus the 600 or so lawyers who the center is coordinating in the habeas fight, many of us went to Washington over the last few weeks in an attempt to get the Democrats to say, we will restore habeas. The means of doing that was to try and add it to the defense authorization bill coming out of the House. The theory being that if there was a defense authorization bill that needed to be passed, that the president wouldn't veto that and you could attach habeas to it. Sadly, we were deeply disappointed by the Democrats on this issue. They said to us, if you can get the votes in the House Armed Services Committee of the House, we will agree to go with it. In the end, we got the votes. We counted. We did a nose count. In the end, the Democrats did not put it into the bill. And so we're still left with litigating on behalf of Guantanamo detainees without any habeas right. Dahlia, I don't know if you want to add to that. I know Amnesty has a major campaign around this issue as well.
Well, I think one of the things we want to encourage all listeners who can to participate in is to join with the June 26th Day of Action to Restore Law and Justice. It's sponsored by Amnesty International, CCR is involved, National Lawyers Guild is involved, the ACLU is involved. The main events are on the 26th, a rally in Washington, D.C., and a lobby day where we go and visit representatives and ask them to restore habeas. Then that whole week, we're holding district lobby weeks all around the country. So people who can't make it to D.C. can still be part of the action. And we're asking folks to get together in delegations, and we're organizing these delegations to go do the district visits to restore habeas and amend other problematic portions of the Military Commissions Act. If individuals want to apply to be a delegation leader, they can go to amnestyusa.org, can apply to be a delegation leader, or you can just even sign up to join a delegation. If you're not sure what's happening in your hometown, but you're concerned about this, you want to visit your representative, and you want to let him or her know that this is unacceptable, you can absolutely hook up with a group of people who are doing the same.
I want to say how important this is and emphasize what Di is saying in your participation on June 26th. You know, when we think about the difference between a so-called democracy and a police state, habeas is actually one of the critical differences, because without habeas, it allows the president, dictator, king, whatever, to throw people into prison and leave them there forever without giving them access to courts. That's sadly the situation we have now for non-citizens who are held as enemy combatants. So that what Di is saying here is really crucial, because it is really what differentiates even a semblance of democracy from something else.
You know, people don't have the sense in this country that really where we're heading. What this means is that the administration is really trying to rein in the ability to pick up anybody off the streets, detain them, never let them see a court, disappear forever from your family, your friends. I mean, this particularly targets people who are non-citizens, but they've really tried to extend this power to citizens, to all people. They want the power to put everyone in jail without ever letting them have a day in court, just on the president's say-so, which is an extremely frightening thing. I mean, we have the first person, a U.S. citizen, who was originally declared an enemy combatant or deemed an enemy combatant by the president, now finally undergoing a criminal trial after, what, 5 years of fighting?
And that's Jose Padilla, who's on trial in Florida for a criminal charge. But you have to understand what happened here. A U.S. citizen held for 5 years, really without habeas for a long period of that, tortured for a long period of that, and finally, when they get it to the Supreme Court to test whether or not he can be detained as an enemy combatant without a trial, the government doesn't want that tested, the Bush administration being afraid of that, of a decision on a U.S. citizen enemy combatant, and then they charge him with a crime in Florida, and he's currently on trial.
For years, Bush administration said, okay, look, we can't try him. He's too dangerous to be tried through the criminal justice system, so we have to create this alternate system of injustice, which does not allow him to ever see a court. They fought him even seeing his lawyers. They held him in solitary confinement for years. He has not been able to speak and communicate with his family. And mentally, he's really declined, so much so that, you know, when we interviewed his attorney, one of his attorneys, Andy Patel, a couple months ago, Andy was telling us that Jose Padilla wasn't even sure that Andy Patel was really his lawyer working for him. He thought that maybe he and the other lawyers, defense attorneys, might be some type of government agent working against Jose Padilla. So it's in this kind of atmosphere that he was transferred, when it looked like he really was going to get, the United States was going to get ordered to either charge or release him. They've moved him to a criminal court, and they said, okay, he's now a criminal detainee. He's no longer an enemy combatant. And for the entire time, the 5 years that they had been publicly telling Americans and the rest of the world that this person was a very dangerous terrorist, that he had plans to set off a radioactive dirty bomb in apartment buildings all over Chicago and kill innocent civilians, all the charges they lobbied against him just disappeared. All of a sudden, they charged him with stuff that was completely new, saying that, you know, he was part of an Al-Qaeda terrorist support cell that provided equipment, money, and fighters to militant groups around the world.
So I think that what we're saying in this update is America better wake up. We got Padilla out there, we got habeas, and I just want to, as we close this little part on habeas, because then I know you and I want to discuss the czar, the new war czar, but there's an article that I just looked at, it was written a couple of weeks ago by Naomi Wolf. It's called American fascism in 10 easy steps. And of course, one of them is this critical issue of habeas pedia. Another important update is the recent appointment of a war czar. When I was speaking with Dahlia, Dahlia said, Michael, what is this about? So Dahlia, what is this about?
Now, the war czar, another one of the Bush administration's nightmares. It's a newly created position that's supposed to coordinate the military and civilian operations and manage the Washington side of things in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So he's going to be overseeing the conflicts and the occupation in those countries. What is so interesting to me is that so many other accomplished military personnel have rejected this post. This post has been open for months. The Bush administration has really been trying very hard to fill it. I think the National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, has been the person at the head of this search. And person after person declined to take this position because they said it was a loser. Marine General John Sheehan, who turned it down and said, you know, we already have a war czar, that's the president.
Plus, we have a Secretary of Defense, and there's, you know, the major thing that Secretary of Defense is concerned by is two wars going on, Afghanistan and Iraq. So what is it, what's really going on? Is it papering it over and saying to the Congress and the American people, see, we're doing something, we're going to try and do this better?
You know, I don't know what this is about. The proposal to create this job, it developed, to my knowledge, after Megan O'Sullivan. She was the 37-year-old woman who had the highest Security Council job on Iraq and Afghanistan. And so she developed policy, you know, Iraq policy and Afghanistan policy where the U.S. was concerned, but didn't actually have the ability to follow through on it and to implement the policy. I don't know what they what they think is going to change here, because no one is saying that Lute would now have the power to implement direct policies. I think he's directly answerable to the president, and as we know, the president does what he wants to do. And you know what's interesting about Lute is he hasn't been in step with the administration this entire time. I think he just is changing his public mind because he wants this job. He has said incredibly publicly in interviews, in an interview with the Financial Times, almost 2 years ago, in August 2005, he said, look, we need to reduce the troops. We can't be, this is not, it's not a good time to, you know, for a troop surge, and we should not support a troop surge. That's a disaster. He said, quote, you simply have to back off and let the Iraqis step forward. You have to undercut the perception of occupation in Iraq. And now all of a sudden he supports, he's come in line with the Bush administration and supports the recent troop surge.
Well, that's remarkable.
Still going on.
I don't think that has come out very publicly, that he was originally opposed to the surge, essentially. One thing that, his name was interesting to me. The first thing I thought of, because his last name is Lute, it's Douglas Lute, L-U-T-E. And of course, a lute is a musical instrument, much like a fiddle, I guess. Well, not really like a fiddle, no. But anyway, but it reminded me of Nero fiddled while Rome burned. So now you got President Bush basically looting, or whatever the word is, while Iraq and Afghanistan burn. But, you know, this guy is not in there to withdraw troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's really a sad commentary.
Well, I mean, what I think this guy needs to do is this guy needs to go in there and to communicate to the president what he's been unwilling to listen to from, and to the public, from that he's heard from military commanders across the board just over and over again, that this is the way that they're, that this war and this occupation is a losing endeavor. They're never going to win.
And I love the term czar, right? War czar. I mean, what are we, you know?
Well, they moved back from that, you know. They're now not calling it a... That's not the official. I think previously this administration has no idea of how imperialist or how they
That's
sound.
Great. I didn't know they moved away from the word czar.
Well, they did. The official, I believe Stephen Hadley said, the official position is something like coordinator.
Very
makes
funny.
It sounds like an after-school
right,
job.
Right.
You know, you coordinate. But I think we need to focus on what Lute has to be held accountable for doing, and that's for telling the truth that he did before, that he said the surge is not the way to go. We need to pull out. I mean, he didn't say pull out completely, but at least he was saying reduction.
Oh, that's great that you're bringing that up. I have not read or seen that anywhere.
Well, you know, and we can't forget about all the top U.S. generals who refused this position, who said the war czar position is a loser position. I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with it. One of the four-star generals who was invited to take this position, declined because he said the war was being handled in a chaotic way, led by Bush Cheney. The Bush administration really was not interested in looking for a way out, and that's what they needed to do. I don't think anything's going to change with this war czar. We can hope, but that the best could come out of a bad situation. But the fact that they even looked for someone like this is concerning.
So we can look forward to more war, Dahlia.
I know.
Very sad.
I know. When General Sheehan said, when he rejected it, he said, "So rather than go over there, develop an ulcer, and eventually leave," I said, "No thanks."
That's great. Well, I think we'll end our little update on that note, Dahlia.
Yep.
Thanks. Recently, demonstrators in Canada, Mexico, Central and South America, and across dozens of major cities in the United States protested the release of admitted former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles. Carriles is accused of being the mastermind of a 1976 mid-air explosion that destroyed a Cuban airliner, killing 73 people. Amazingly, after he snuck into the United States illegally, he was recently released from prison and is now wandering our streets again. Think about it. A former CIA operative accused of masterminding the explosion of a Cuban airliner that killed 73 human beings. An obvious terrorist wandering around in the United States. Among the many voices protesting the release of Posada, we will hear former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and our own Heidi Boghossian. Let's have a listen.
Our first speaker today, Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General.
Well, thanks to everybody for being here. It's awfully important. I'll make one correction from that remarkably effective opening statement. El Paso, Texas was left out. There's a big demonstration going on down there. That's, of course, the place where the federal court was sitting that released this guy we're here to talk about today. I was supposed to be down there, but once they released him, we decided it'd be better to be where there are more folks. And let me tell you that the University of Texas at El Paso has a large delegation at the meeting, and it'll be a terrific meeting, and the El Paso newspapers have been covering it. You need to read the opinion of the judge. The first sentence of a 36-page opinion that released Luis Posada Carriles says, "The defendant, Luis Posada Carriles, a Cuban national, 79 years old, has spent his life opposing Fidel Castro." Now tell me what that has to do with the law or with the court's opinion. The fact is that he was at least 30 years old before Fidel Castro came to power. Her opinion states that Luis spent 25 years working for the CIA after that, in 5 years as an officer in the U.S. Army. So he was opposing, according to her opinion, Fidel Castro as a member of the CIA and the U.S. Army, which may show us where the real problem is. We have to get hold of this situation. These immigration charges weren't significant. I mean, if he'd been convicted on all of them under the guidelines, he wouldn't have gotten 30 months. The significant thing is that 73 people were killed. A host of them were youngsters. There was a fencing team from Cuba, teenagers primarily. There's another athletic team from Guyana. There's a family out here on Long Island in the paper here today, grieving because they lost a relative on that plane. And where does he have sanctuary? Here in the United States. He participated in the Bay of Pigs. He was a part of the Contra effort to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. He's claimed that he was responsible for setting bombs in hotels, tourist hotels, in Cuba, in which at least one person, an Italian tourist, was killed and a dozen seriously injured. He had planned to set off a major explosion at the University of Panama at a meeting where 2,000 students were rallying to greet Fidel Castro, and he was caught before the bomb went off. This is our kind of guy, isn't he? We have to demand that there be hearings in the Congress to completely analyze what he was doing these 25 years he was working for the CIA. Is he just fruit from the poisonous tree? Is that what he is? Are we really responsible for this kind of thing? Was the CIA behind the destruction of that airplane? And we remember that up until 9/11, there was not an aircraft blown from the air by criminal conduct that killed more people in the history of the hemisphere before that day in October of 1976. How do you think you'll ever have peace on Earth if the United States gives sanctuary to terrorists like that? We've got to change this government, and the place to begin is impeachment. If we fail to impeach George Bush and his vice president and other high officials of the government, then we fail to live up to the Constitution. If we impeach him, we'll solve all these problems. The Congress is not going to have courage until the people stand up and demand it. And it's up to you and me. And we might as well begin with Luis Posado. He's not our kind of terrorist. We don't believe in violence that kills people like that. We do believe in freedom, and he's an enemy of freedom, as is our government. If you want to know about terrorism, look at Iraq. The United States is the greatest terrorist on earth. Shock and awe killed tens of thousands of people. Hundreds of thousands have died as a direct result of our violence. Since then, 2 million people have fled their own country. 2 million more are exiled in their own country. Iraq now has the highest death rate for infants in the world. It's come up from a very good rate to the highest rate, about 162 deaths per live births, all because of our action. 3/4 of the population doesn't have safe drinking water. You never know when you're going to die there. There are explosions constantly, danger and violence everywhere. And the United States has caused it, and George Bush is responsible. And there has to be accountability. So let's pull up our socks and do the job. And let's get Posado charged as he should be. If we won't extradite him to Venezuela, then he has to be tried here under the Montreal Convention, which requires it. You can't give sanctuary to murderers, mass murderers, like Luis Posada Carriles.
From the National Lawyers Guild.
The National Lawyers Guild wants to thank the Answer Coalition for bringing this atrocity and the atrocity of the Cuban Five condition into the public's conscience. Thank you. What do Luis Posada Carriles and President George W. Bush have in common? They have both violated the law, committed unspeakable crimes against humanity, and have done so with impunity. As the terrorist Posada is set free, the Cuban Five, who tried to stop anti-Cuba terrorist groups, languish in jail around this country. the mistreatment of the Cuban Five and the release of Posada illustrate the hypocrisy of the Bush administration, which incessantly touts its war on terror. As this government continues to wage an illegal and immoral invasion of Iraq, all in the name of national security, it disregards the right of Cuba to defend its homeland from terrorist activity from this country. George Bush has his own special definition of terrorism. Anyone who disagrees with his policies, from the Cubans to ordinary American citizens who dare exercise their constitutional right to speak out against his unjust policies. Bush doesn't think that the longtime CIA agent who boasted of helping to detonate deadly bombs in Havana hotels 10 years ago is a terrorist, even though he was the alleged mastermind in the 1976 bombing of the civilian Cuban airplane that killed 73 innocent people. That's because Bush shuts his eyes when it comes to U.S.-sponsored terrorism. By releasing Posada, the U.S. government has violated Security Council Resolution 1373, passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks. That resolution mandates that all countries deny safe haven to those who commit terrorist acts and ensure that they are brought to justice. 1373 echoes Bush's own words. If you don't oppose terrorism, you support it. These provisions of Resolution 1373 are mandatory, as they were adopted under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. The U.S. government has also violated three treaties that require it to extradite Posada to Venezuela for trial or to try him in U.S. courts for offenses that he committed abroad. Roberto Gonzalez, brother of Rene, who sits in prison, says that the message we are sending to Cuba by releasing Posada is that your lives in Cuba don't matter. Our lives do not need protection, is what he told me a couple of weeks ago when I visited Cuba. The U.S. can use bombs, airplanes, and embassies because we despise you. If the U.S. denies the right to defense for Cuba of terrorist actions from this country, we are telling the Cubans your lives have no value. The National Lawyers Guild calls for a congressional hearing to examine the U.S. government's role in promoting impunity in the Posada case. We demand an explanation as to why the Justice Department did not invoke the U.S. Patriot Act to declare Posada a terrorist and to detain him, stating, the release of Mr. Posada puts into question our commitment to fight terrorism. The brave five men who sit in jail, the Cuban Five, are heroes to Cuba, and they're heroes to those of us who value justice. For they went after the real terrorists. They peacefully infiltrated criminal exile groups in Miami to prevent terrorism against Cuba. They turned over the results of their investigation to our FBI. But instead of working with Cuba to fight terrorism, the hypocritical U.S. government arrested the five Cubans. A three-trial panel in the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed their convictions, finding they could not receive a fair trial in Miami because of the perfect storm of prejudicial influences that exists there. The U.S. media has not only been irresponsibly silent after that wonderful decision was rejected about the five, but many reporters in Florida have accepted money by the United States government to write false stories about the Cubans. This is just one example of how our administration has corrupted the media, which should be a watchdog against government injustice and hypocrisy. And in the case of the five, their trial was aimed at framing them for actions they did not commit, at the same time protecting real terrorists. Prosecutor told Rene Gonzalez, sentenced to 16 years, that if he gave false testimony against his compatriots, he would be freed. But Rene refused to lie. The judge said, quote, expressed concern that this defendant, after completing a sentence, would resume his activities. And the judge then added 15-year sentence. even though the court explicitly recognized that Miami is a haven for terrorist individuals and groups, and that nothing is done in that respect, even though Bush has declared a war on terror. We've waged an aggressive war against Cuba for nearly 50 years. It has killed thousands. We've hijacked planes and boats, smuggled tons of explosives into the island, derailed trains, burned factories, and now we've let Posada go free. Mr. President, who is for terrorism and who is against it?
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you very much for that. Now, are we gonna let a little rain get in our way?
No.
Wait, I didn't hear you?
No.
Okay, all right, just checking.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Here at Law and Disorder, we've been updating you on the fate of former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's been on death row for 25 years in Pennsylvania. Last week, the United States Circuit for the Third Circuit heard an appeal from his conviction, really a writ of habeas corpus. He was convicted in state court. He was convicted of the murder of a police officer following a trial that was filled with errors before a predominantly white jury. This appeal may be one of his last hopes. We believe there's good issues on the appeal. We're hopeful about what will happen. Our own Heidi Boghossian was in the courts and at the rallies outside the court during the argument. We go now to hear from Heidi Boghossian and the voices of activists and supporters of Mumia from that day last week.
Standing outside the federal courthouse in Philadelphia, just ended 2 hours of oral arguments in the appeal of Mumia Abu-Jamal. There are scores of police and various levels of military outfit here, and several hundred demonstrators peacefully assembling with Free Mumia signs. With us is Zachary Wolf from the National Lawyers Guild, who was in the courtroom. Zach, what are your reactions to how the oral arguments went?
We are all hopeful that the court is appropriately concerned for the grave injustices and misconduct that has occurred over the last decades in this case. One of the remarkable aspects of it, in listening in the court, there's a lot of technical discussion of prima facie case, at what level are we, at what stage are we. What this really boils down to is that this long after the unjust conviction, Mumia is still fighting just to be able to make his arguments to the court, just to be able to be heard at the initial stages, to be allowed to make his case for the racial discrimination that occurred at his 1982 trial.
I thought that the three-judge panel seemed very sympathetic to defense's arguments. Do you agree with that?
It certainly seemed that way in many times. I think it's always a dangerous thing to try to speculate on what a court will do based on what types of questions they ask. It's hard to say why they're being hard on one person versus another or why they're going down a certain line of questioning. It could be that they want to rule in that way, or it could be that they want to come up with reasons to rule against them. So I think it's really difficult and probably not a good exercise to try to make a guess about where we're going to come out.
Good point, Zach. However, I got the feeling that the Batson arguments, which are the arguments that there were unfair peremptory challenges used to keep African Americans off the jury in this case, I thought that was a strong argument, and as Robert Bryan, Mumia's lead attorney, commented in his five-minute rebuttal, to look at this case in the context of cases in which the Supreme Court has held that there was pervasive racism and unlawful use of peremptory challenges in several Supreme Court cases the year after Mumia's trial. How are we to think that anything was different during his highly politicized trial, where mention of his affiliation in the past with the Black Panther, support for the MOVE organization, it would seem an anomaly and a strange one at that.
Right, and that was an extremely strong part of the argument, I thought. Robert Bryan pointed out that the courts, as well as serious scholarly studies and thoughtful commentary and surveys, have indicated that there was a tremendous pattern of use of racial bias in order to exclude blacks from juries. We all know that as a obvious gut understanding, but the important point is that it's been recognized by the courts again and again. And Robert Bryan pointed out that it would be rather bizarre to believe that this was the exception to that rule.
Zach Wolf, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure you'll agree it was quite an honor to be there in the courtroom today.
It was. Thank you.
Let's run into Judith Ritter, who's co-counsel on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Judith, you were absolutely wonderful in court today. How do you feel that it went?
I feel that it went pretty well. I think that on the issue I argued, which was the penalty phase problem, I think it went particularly well because I think we have the law very clearly on our side. And I think it went well with regard to the other aspects, too. The judges seemed to zero in on the part of the issue and did not seem to be very concerned with the procedural defenses that were raised repeatedly by the Commonwealth in the case.
And so now we wait a few months. What is it usually, 3 or 4 months before a decision?
Yeah, usually it can be months, but this case is unusual, so it might be less, it might be more. It's really impossible to say. Usually months.
Any comments on the three judges who heard the arguments today?
They were very, very well prepared, and they knew the record very well, which is usually the case in this circuit, but it certainly was true today. They asked good questions. They asked smart questions. They listened to the answers, and they seemed to be very concerned with getting the facts right, because there's so many here, and they seem to be very, very meticulous about what's been in the record and what does the record say. So I was very impressed with their level of preparation.
And we were impressed with you, Judith. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi, for being here.
We're delighted to have run into Clark Kissinger from New York. Clark, you were in the courtroom. What did you think?
I thought two things. One is that the judges themselves were extremely well prepared, both in terms of their knowledge of the case and the knowledge of the relevant law. And it was seen from the word go when the state's attorney, Burns, was virtually shot down from the opening moment. Not that he was such a bad attorney, but he had such a difficult case to try and to present to the court. So that at the end of the over 2 hours of oral argumentation by both sides in this case, I feel relatively hopeful. I think this is particularly true on the issue of the jury form, which I think that Mumia is clearly going to win on this. And then the real question here, and I think the major argument that you heard all day long or all morning long in the court on is whether the prima facie case had been established to begin the whole Batson review. And if that's followed through, and they're willing to entertain that argument and then go into the substantive end of it, it's only going to redound to Mumia's favor, because at the end I thought that this is where Mumia's lead attorney got to the heart of the issue, where in his closing remarks he listed all of the major cases here in Philadelphia where the federal courts have found the local justice system guilty of racism in case after case after case after case. And then he says, are we being asked now to believe that the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former Black Panther, an associate of the MOVE organization, charged with killing a white police officer, that this is the only case in which this racism was not pervasive?
It was a really compelling closing. I agree with you. Just can you clarify for our listeners, you mentioned the jury form issue. What exactly is that all about?
Well, at the federal district level, Judge Yawn, hearing Mumia's habeas petition, had thrown out his death penalty because the jury form that was given to the jurors to record their verdict on very clearly gave the impression that to list any mitigating circumstances, and whether he got the death penalty or not had to do with whether aggravating circumstances outweighed mitigating circumstances. Under the law here in Pennsylvania, to list mitigating circumstances did not require a unanimous agreement by the jury. Yet the form that the jurors were given was written so that any reasonable person reading it would believe that in order to list a mitigating circumstance, you had to be in unanimous agreement. And I think that aspect of this case was very well explored in the testimony today, and I think it's one that Mumia is clearly going to win on.
Okay, my name is Mike Gimbel. I'm a delegate to the New York City Central Labor Council and also a first vice president of my union chapter. My union was one of the original unions endorsing the Mumia rally at Javits Center, part of the district council, and our union played the main role in getting the district council to endorse the Mumia rally at Javits Center. So it's not exactly a new thing for me to be at a rally like this. There are hundreds of people out here in support of Mumia on a work day. And anybody who works for a living knows how difficult it is to get people out during a work day. And the fact that we have hundreds of people here is a testament to the support that Mumia has. His issue is our issue. Our opponents against the labor movement are the same people who want to kill Mumia. And if we do not understand that an injury to one is an injury to all, then we lose the union movement as well as the fight for Mumia.
I'm hoping what these judges might do is craft a new Batson way of looking at things, which would be you take into consideration first that they did knock off 10 out of 15, and then you craft that onto the fact that they left whites on for the same reasons they knocked blacks off. If the bench is any indication, I think we're in better shape than we might have been.
Okay, and if Mumia wins at this stage, what will that mean exactly?
Well, I think the most it would mean that it'll be sent back for a new trial. That's what I think. They're not about to throw the whole case out. That I don't think. That was not argued that way at all. Yeah.
What are the strongest things that you heard from your defense?
Well, I think that the strongest is the Batson issue, that's what the court was most interested in. But they also spent a long time on the question of, there was a jury instruction also. It all revolves around the jury. Everything that they did revolved around the jury. Whether or not a jury instruction that was given was the right instruction, and whether or not the a verdict sheet that had the ultimate verdict, the death penalty, was a fair verdict sheet, or whether it led them unnecessarily. So it all revolves around the jury, and we know, hopefully, that's a good thing for us. My take is, as I say, overall optimistic, I hope. but I have a tendency that way anyway.
Now, one complaint was that they didn't really seem to deal with Judge Szabo or any really other
issues. That's out of the case. Unfortunately, the law, which was enacted under our friend Bill Clinton, Safe Street, and what is it called? Effective death penalty and anti-terrorism. Why do I always forget that terrorism word? But anyway, enacted under him was that you must give deference to a state court decision. In other words, so the state court decisions that found that Szabo was okay, the federal courts have to go along with. They can't question that issue again. So that was not on the table. These jury issues were, the instruction issue was, because the judge basically said, you don't have to worry about it if you find the guilty, because he'll have appeal after appeal after appeal. And that took away from them the ability to really make a fair decision. And of course, it's a complete misstatement of the law also.
And I'm here because I'm in support of Mumia getting a new trial. Like, I'm not sure if he's innocent or guilty, but I know, like, all the things I have read and have seen, there's evidence that he did not receive a fair trial, and with more evidence coming through, why can't he get a new trial? You know, this is a democracy. What is the world afraid of? If the man is really guilty, well, if he has a new trial, same scenario is going to happen, right? So like I said, I'm here to see that he gets a new and fair trial this time. Other than that, you know, people should have fair trial. That's what I'm about.
We're just here because we feel that he didn't get a fair trial and that Mumia is innocent. We just don't think he shot the police officer. We just think it's rigged, and they just wanted him because he was a former Black Panther, an outspoken, you know, member of the community. And you can't do that and be African American in Philadelphia.
We're here with Jeff Mackler, longtime friend of Law and Disorder, who was in the courtroom today. Jeff, what are your thoughts about how it went?
Well, I thought it was a great day for Mumia. I thought that the four issues before the court were clearly presented, and I think that the judges were obviously receptive and prepared on every single flaw that we have been arguing on these four points for years. The judges seemed to me to be on point. Of course, we have to go through a procedure where they resolve these constitutional issues in the absence of the evidence that has appeared so many times in the past that proves Mumia's innocence. So if we win on the constitutional issues, a new trial, I think, is in the offing, or at least a remand back to the federal district court, which will open up the door to a new trial. And I think if Mumia wins a new trial, the evidence that we can present for the first time, demonstrating his evidence, his innocence on every question, will be overwhelming, and Mumia will be a free man. So while I can never count and will never give you a sworn affidavit as to what any court in this country will do, I think the presence of so many thousands of people here on the one hand, a packed courtroom with Mumia's supporters, has had an impact, and I think that the impact that we can expect is a positive one for Mumia after 25-year drought.
Jeff, thank you. One final question. Any comments on how you felt the prosecution did in presenting their case?
Well, I think the prosecution, tried to find every exception to the laws that bind them in order to present it to the court. And I think the judges ridiculed them. That was my personal opinion. Every time they explained why Batson didn't apply, why the exclusion of Black jurors was irrelevant, why Joseph McGill's comments to the effect that if the jury finds him guilty, they don't have to worry about it because he's going to have appeal after appeal. And in the sentencing hearing, when Judge Szabo's instructions, written instructions, clearly violated the law, in every single case, the prosecution tried to come up with irrelevant cases, and the judges carefully dissected each one, in my view, and showed the irrelevance of their argument, even making some comments to the effect that that argument really doesn't help you, it works on the other side. So once again, I don't have a crystal ball, I'm not an attorney, but in my view, all of the issues that were raised by the defense and attempted to be answered by the prosecution fell short on the prosecution side and long on our side. Well, what did you think, Heidi? Did you think the judges were receptive?
I couldn't have been more pleased. They were, as you said, extremely well prepared, and I know we can't predict what will happen, but I felt that they peppered the state with so many questions and indeed did seem to almost ridicule them, poking holes into many of the assertions. And to me, they seemed highly favorable to the defense attorneys who argued. So I am very happy with how it went in there.
That's exactly my view. I mean, every single bit of constitutional information, relevant information, jury selection, exclusion of blacks, whether it be the Baldus study, which showed that blacks had been systematically excluded for a long time, a decade from Pennsylvania juries, all of it came out, and the prosecution tried to answer it to no avail, in my view. So I think our side did well, and I think I'm glad people mobilized here today. The courtroom was filled. I was surprised that so many of us got in. The police obviously didn't show up to take their half of the courtroom, and the additional time, 1 hour for each side, was absolutely necessary and helped me. You should know that the prosecution is afraid of this court. They literally tried to recuse the entire Third Circuit, which has a reputation of being, next to California, the most liberal group of judges in the country. Once again, I don't know if that means anything, but the prosecution certainly did not want to be before these judges, and they were forced to. The judges were very well prepared. I was shocked at how well they had referenced the cases, how many times they intervened to contradict the prosecution, and how many times they almost appear to be intervening to help the defense. So because the arguments are there, the constitutional questions were well made, and I think everybody did a great job.
Thank you, Jeff.
The only thing we know is he was framed up, he's innocent, and the reason why is because he's a revolutionary.
Yes, sir.
If they kill him or keep him on death row, any of us could be next. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Free Mumia Abu-Jamal!
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.